It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's Department of Justice has some big issues on the table. A USA Today investigation shows states, including Wisconsin, receive millions of federal dollars to test a backlog of rape kits. But convictions resulting from those tests remain low.
And less than 6 weeks before the presidential election, how is the State Department of Justice preparing for a potentially rocky election aftermath?
Attorney General Josh Call joins us now. Attorney General Call, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the sexual assault test kits, a long-running story here in Wisconsin, a widely noted backlog of testing. First of all, big picture, Attorney General Call, how have we done on that that backlog over the last few years?
Well, in Wisconsin, we've really transformed the way that sexual assault kits are treated, and also the response that we take to sexual assault. This is a serious violent crime, and it's critical that offenders are held accountable. And we've made a number of changes in Wisconsin over the last several years that help make sure that that happens. So with respect to the backlog of untested kits, after the testing of those kits that were designated for testing was completed, at the Department of Justice, we reviewed every case where there was DNA from somebody other than the victim that was identified. We had a multidisciplinary team review each case that involved a prosecutor, an investigator, and a victim advocate. And where there was potential for further investigation or prosecution, those cases were referred to local law enforcement or prosecutors. That has resulted in some convictions. One of the cases that resulted from that was a case involving an individual who was free, was on the street, and who ultimately was convicted of 3 counts of second-degree sexual assault and 2 counts of false imprisonment in connection with offenses in Racine and Kenosha County. He was sentenced to 18 years in prison. But we've also worked to make sure that there's policy reform so we don't ever have a backlog of sexual assault kits again. We launched at the Department of Justice a sexual assault kit tracking system so that survivors can go online and see where their kit is in the testing process at a time of their choosing. We also work to get legislation passed that requires that kits be submitted into different parts of the process within particular timeframes to make sure that kits aren't sitting around untested. So because of those changes, we are now in a far better position in Wisconsin than we had been prior to those changes.
Now, according to that USA Today investigation, through this effort, 10 people have been convicted of sexual assault in Wisconsin as a result of this catching up on testing. People might hear that and say, 10, you know, all these kits, all these tests, all this effort, and only 10 convictions. Can you put that number in perspective?
Absolutely. First, anytime you're holding somebody accountable who's committed a serious violent crime like this, That's a very positive step for public safety, and it's a positive step for getting justice for survivors. And as I mentioned with the case involving the individual who was sentenced to 18 years in prison, that case alone is a very serious conviction impacting public safety. But more significantly, the work that was done has allowed us to ensure that survivors know that their kits are being tested. It's led to the kind of policy changes I've talked about. And it's helping us send what I think is a vitally important message, which is that survivors of sexual assault should know that if they come forward and report, their reports are going to be taken seriously by law enforcement. And we've worked to do that not only through the sexual assault kit testing, but by training prosecutors about sexual assault prosecutions, by launching our clergy and faith leader abuse initiative, and by emphasizing the importance of these cases. It's vital that Wisconsinites know that these cases are going to be taken seriously and that we're going to work to hold offenders accountable.
And before we move on from that investigation, they found in 2023, the State Department of Justice had more than 6,800 kits. 2,300 went untested. Your department, I understand, says it's for a variety of reasons. The victim maybe didn't give permission, police reports not filed or were missing. The federal grant program, as I understand it anyway, recommends that, hey, we should be testing all of these kits regardless of those circumstances. Can you talk about that discrepancy?
Yeah, when the sexual assault kit initiative was launched under when my predecessor was AG, a decision was made by the Department of Justice to test kits where there was consent for the testing provided by the survivor of sexual assault. DOJ has consistently taken a victim-centric approach in the handling of sexual assault kits. And that includes testing kits where consent was provided, but not engaging in tests where there was not consent provided by the victim. We believe that ensuring that victims are in control of the process is critical. And to the extent that folks, that victims want to have kits tested at their discretion, those kits will be tested. That's an approach that has been in place for years in Wisconsin. As I mentioned, it predates my decision or my becoming attorney general. But ultimately, making sure that there's consent is key. We've now set up the process so that when kits are obtained, that consent is offered at the time. If survivors don't want to consent to the testing, but they want to have evidence collected, we've created a statutory process that allows that to happen. But fundamentally, our goal is to ensure that we're taking a victim-centric approach.
We're talking to Josh Call, Attorney General of Wisconsin. Turning to election season, Attorney General Call, there's been attention in 2024 to the 2020 so-called fake electors around the country. These would be Republican slates of electors who signed certifications saying, hey, we're the electors, though the Democrat Joe Biden had won in their state. Now, in June, you filed felony charges against some of the attorneys involved in that who helped submit that paperwork. What is the status of those cases?
As you mentioned, we filed criminal charges against three individuals who we have alleged were involved with the so-called fake elector scheme. We've made clear that that's an ongoing investigation. And so both the prosecution is ongoing, as is the investigation. We are going to continue to follow the facts where they lead and make decisions based on the facts and the law. It's critical that we protect the integrity of our elections in Wisconsin. That's what we have done at DOJ, and that's what we're going to continue to do.
Some states have pursued legal action against the electors, the fake electors themselves. Not Wisconsin. Any thought of revisiting that?
Well, like I said, this is an ongoing investigation, and we're going to follow the facts where they lead. Each state has slightly different facts and circumstances, and ultimately, our decisions need to be based on the facts that we have and what the law dictates. Our goal is to gather as much information as possible about the facts and ensure that as decisions are made about prosecution or as the cases proceed in the cases involving the individuals that were charged, that we are presenting the facts fully and thoroughly.
Concern around the country, Attorney General Call, about threats to election workers, clerks who run elections in their municipality or county. How are you and your department preparing for a safe and secure election in November?
We've worked on a number of elections at this point to ensure that the will of the voters is protected and that we have safe and secure and free and fair elections in Wisconsin. So we're going to do a lot of the same things now that we did in 2020. We want to make clear to the public that intimidation of voters and interference with the voting process is illegal. And if people commit those crimes, they need to expect to be held accountable. Threats to our election officials are unacceptable, and criminal threats need to be taken very seriously and investigated fully. We work with the Wisconsin Election Commission and with local law enforcement and DAs to ensure that folks have the information and the resources that they need to hold accountable anybody who is interfering with our election process unlawfully. And what I can say is that we have a long history of dealing with challenges here at DOJ, and we have a lot of close elections in Wisconsin. Prior to 2020, there was a lot of concern about voter intimidation at the polls, and we made clear that that would lead to consequences for anybody who engaged in it. Fortunately, things went smoothly in the conduct of the election. Now, we've also had a number of challenges to issues relating to elections in Wisconsin, whether it's an effort to purge tens of thousands of voters from the rolls. We defended against that, and we won. When there were efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, we defended against those efforts, and we upheld the will of the voters. Michael Gabelman conducted an investigation authorized by Robin Voss in the state assembly. I made very clear what our concerns were about that, and ultimately that investigation was shut down. Likewise, there's an ongoing attempt to remove the administrator of the Wisconsin Election Commission that we've defended against. But what I can say is that we have consistently defended our voting system and our elections. We have consistently won. And I'm confident that once again, we will have a safe and secure election and that the will of the voters will prevail.
In our last minute, how are you gearing up for the run-up to Election Day? Election Day itself, likely to be a lot of legal issues, concerns, court challenges. What are you doing to prepare?
Well, first, we want to make clear to the public what the laws are. As you mentioned, threats to election officials are a concern. And it's important that people know that those are going to be taken very seriously by law enforcement. It's critical that voters are able to cast their ballot without interference and that the officials who are stepping up to administer our elections are able to do so without interference. And we have a long history of safe and secure elections in Wisconsin. Our elections have been tested through recounts and legal actions and reviews. And consistently, those have shown that our results reflect the will of the voters. We do have some ongoing litigation. We're going to, of course, continue to litigate those cases. And we fully anticipate that there will be that there could be challenges to the results after the election. We will litigate those fully and defend the will of the voters, just as we did in 2020. And again, I'm confident that the will of the voters will prevail.
Attorney General Call, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Josh Call, Attorney General of Wisconsin. He talked to us today about election security over the next few weeks and convictions resulting from the testing of backlog sexual assault evidence kits, long-running backlog here in the state.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a cybersecurity summit planned for Milwaukee aims to help grow this industry in Wisconsin.
This brings together those technology leaders to share what our best practice, what are lessons learned, how can we work together as a cybersecurity community.
Efforts to improve digital security, that's ahead on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In this year's election, both parties are competing for every last vote in Wisconsin. For Republicans in rural areas, that means trying to expand the party's already massive advantage.
For Democrats, it means trying to reverse more than a decade's worth of declines. From North Central Wisconsin, WPR's Rob Mentzer reports.
Dave Thompson is a retired dairy farmer from Taylor County. He and his wife, LaVon, are lifelong Democrats, but they've only recently gotten involved in their local party, including its parades.
He drives the truck, for
the parade
and that.
Because I got a blue pickup.
The Thompsons spoke outside of a meeting of the Taylor County Democratic Party in September. The party met at the public library next to the Medford Flowage. For Thompson, there's a simple reason that he's gotten more involved in politics.
Well, I don't want to run down anybody, but I didn't want Trump. Well,
that's true.
That's the facts,
Yep.
I don't like the way he talks. I don't like how he runs people down.
In this rural part of the state, most people do not agree with the Thompsons. In 2020, Republican Donald Trump got nearly 72% of the vote in Taylor County. Democrat Joe Biden got barely over 25%. John Germain is co-chair of the Taylor County Democrats. He says the last time the area was remotely close was in 2012, when Barack Obama ran for re-election.
Things shifted pretty rapidly after that. Trump really keyed into the rural voters, I think, with some of their grievances and so forth. And, it's not just this county, obviously. All the rural counties across the country are similar.
For Republicans, the goal in 2024 is to preserve or even grow their lopsided advantage in rural Wisconsin.
Congressman Tom Tiffany, everybody. How's everybody?
At the headquarters of the Oneida County Republican Party in Rhinelander in late August, Republican Congressman Tom Tiffany tells a group of Northwoods volunteers that their efforts matter.
I got to tell you, I feel really good about where we're at here in Wisconsin. We win Wisconsin, Donald Trump wins the presidency. Simple as that.
Tiffany says rural areas' swing to the right started under Republican Governor Scott Walker and continued under Trump.
They saw them as speaking to the average person, speaking to those that, you know, maybe don't have a college education. They've worked their whole lives. And I think they view them as they're speaking for us.
One of the volunteers going door to door for Tiffany is James Rohde. The 17-year-old high school senior says voters he talks to are most concerned about immigration and inflation. But he says at most of the doors he visits, he's not persuading people on the issues. He's reminding them to make it to the polls.
One of the important reasons to go out into these rural areas is even if people might be leaning Republican, that doesn't always mean they're going to vote.
A Trump campaign official says they've identified tens of thousands of likely conservatives they can focus on turning out. They think there's still room to drive Trump's totals up in rural parts of the state. But Democrats are organizing in Trump country. The Kamala Harris campaign now has offices in 43 counties in Wisconsin, including 32 that Trump won in 2020.
We're going to call a meeting to order, Taylor County Democrats.
At the Taylor County Democrats meeting, co-chair Jim Davis makes it clear just how far the party has to go in this part of the state.
If we could get the Democratic vote to 35%, that'd be huge.
Democrats have no expectation of winning a rural county as deep red as Taylor. Their hope is that they can help Harris win the state of Wisconsin if they can lose rural Wisconsin by less. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today.
On Capitol Hill, the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee has introduced a bill to rapidly train up a cybersecurity workforce across government agencies. The legislation targets people who want to make a career pivot into cybersecurity and who don't hold a four-year degree.
Here in Wisconsin, business leaders and educators are gathering for a cybersecurity summit in Milwaukee next month. They'll discuss how to grow the cybersecurity workforce in our state and deal with some of the latest threats in ransomware attacks and hacking.
Milwaukee School of Engineering and Brookfield-based Syslogic are putting on the summit. And here to fill us in is Paul Dukas, Executive Director of Business Development at Syslogic. Paul, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Pete, thank you so much for having me.
You're hosting executive talks from big companies here in Wisconsin. You've got Bolt Company, Children's Wisconsin, some others. What is your goal in bringing corporate leaders together around this issue of cybersecurity?
So cybersecurity is obviously a very hot topic. And year over year, month over month, it gets to be more and more of an issue for companies, people, whether it's ransomware or phishing attacks or what have you. So Syslogic, 5 years ago, in fact, during the month of October, which happens to be Cybersecurity Awareness Month, decided that we wanted to hold a summit and focus in cybersecurity to bring leaders and companies together, very much focused in education to share strategies about latest cybersecurity trends, insights, those types of things.
What are the biggest cybersecurity risks that companies like yours are dealing with here in Wisconsin?
So we serve clients across the commercial sector, and there's a number of different trends. Most notably is the intersection of artificial intelligence and cybersecurity. AI has definitely made its move into cybersecurity, both from a bad actor perspective and from a defensive perspective. So that's a very hot topic. And then, of course, there's others like the role of the chief information security officer, the growing need for leadership support for cybersecurity planning and budgeting for companies, different tools and technologies, and what are the types of attacks like phishing, ransomware, so on and so forth.
There was this recent Deloitte study. It found that more than 60% of knowledge workers are using AI tools at work every day. Are the new generative AI tools that people use putting businesses at additional risk?
So anytime you introduce a new tool, whether it's software, whether it's an AI tool, or any type of a, you know, quite frankly, internet-enabled function, it introduces some new form of risk. It's, think of it as another access point, if you will, for cyber criminals. So for sure, it absolutely does.
Are Wisconsin companies uniquely exposed in any way to digital threats here? What are like some of the biggest vulnerabilities you hear about?
So let me give you some interesting statistics, and I'll jump into vulnerabilities. But one of the biggest types of cyber attacks is called ransomware. In 2021, about every 11 seconds, a business fell victim to ransomware. That was up from 14 seconds in 2019. The frequency of ransomware attacks on governments, businesses, consumers, and devices, it's going to continue to rise over the next 7 years, and it's expected to hit every 2 seconds by 2031.
Wow.
So when you think about that, you think about all the different digital technologies that companies employ today and people employ today, including, you know, devices from homes, refrigerators to thermostats that talk over the internet to companies and devices that support their businesses. They're all exposed to cyber risk. Another interesting statistic, given the importance of the cybersecurity domain, is job gaps. So according to the U.S. Department of Labor, jobs grow at about 3% year over year, generally. In the cybersecurity space, again, according to the United States Department of Labor, forecasts a 32% increase in cybersecurity jobs from 2022 to 2032. So it's massive. There's a huge gap and a great need.
We're going to talk about the education gap in a moment, but I want to return here to the topic of ransomware. And in May, a ransomware attack hit Ascension, the health system that has hospitals in Wisconsin. It brought down their electronic health records at around 140 hospitals around the country. And in June, as Ascension was still recovering from this cyber attack, we talked with Connie Smith, who's president of the Wisconsin Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. And she said some of her nurse colleagues at Ascension St. Francis had never used paper charts before.
We were using forms that were we pulled out of like drawers that hadn't seen the light of day in a long, long time. But I think communication 100% would have helped.
What is effective crisis communication when a cyber attack happens?
So in the world of cybersecurity, there is generally planning around incident response. And organizations like an Ascension Healthcare or other large entities will have very detailed plans on what happens if a ransomware attack occurs. Those plans employ strategies around how do we revert back to maintaining operations for the enterprise, as well as how do we deal with whatever that interval period of time, like in the Ascension case, which took weeks to recover from, how do we deal and maintain operations? So Ascension is actually a very good example, but it's really through incident response planning that entities deal with how do we deal with a ransomware attack if it takes down our core systems.
One aspect of the summit, it features this hardware hacking village, and I'm so curious about what is that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I had mentioned earlier, this is our fifth year of holding the summit. And traditionally, we've taken an approach, and again, we do this year to some degree, where we bring in a variety of different business leaders. But this year, we introduced two tracks. So we have a business track, which will have, of course, panels and speakers and so on and so forth. But we introduced the Hardware Hacking Village as part of our technical track. So for individuals that have interests in really working hands-on with technology like devices, right? Think devices that talk over the internet. This is an opportunity to do so. So to learn about how does cybersecurity affect devices and literally to work hands-on with those products with experts to gain better learning.
Should companies be negotiating with hackers on their data breaches? Is there a precedent with negotiations? Would that be a topic of discussion?
So, you know, I think that's a great question. And each circumstance, whether it's a ransomware attack or other, kind of stands on its own as to whether or not they should or shouldn't negotiate with attackers. You know, that's for their partners, their law firms, and things like that for to decide. I personally don't think so, and that's my personal opinion. I think there's opportunities around incident response and how to deal with hackers and to recover from attacks that should be employed first. And some of these ransomware attacks, I mean, they approach tens to hundreds of millions of dollars in ransom to restore operations, which can obviously become a major fiscal obstacle for public and private sector entities.
The Microsoft Threat Analysis Center has a new report on Russian cyber influence operations, and it really is reflecting the changing politics in our country. It also includes cyber influence operations that are coming from Iran and China. How concerned are Wisconsin companies about foreign actors and the spread of disinformation?
So I had mentioned earlier, we work with a lot of different types of companies, from very large Fortune 100s down to small businesses. I think it's a very significant concern. We hear it from our clients in the services that we perform at SysLogic day to day in working with our clients around cybersecurity. We are extraordinarily sensitive to it. So whether it's threat actors from Russia or China or Iran, it is a very real issue. And people are definitely, the people in organizations that are responsible for it are definitely staying keenly aware to it.
We're talking about the Milwaukee School of Engineering's upcoming Cybersecurity Summit with Paul Dukas, who is Executive Director of Business Development at Brookfield-based SysLogic. Paul, let's talk about education. The summit set at a school of engineering. There was a 2023 cybersecurity jobs report saying there will be 3.5 million unfilled jobs in the cybersecurity industry through next year. How do you scale up this workforce?
So I think it starts with academic entities really investing in cybersecurity programs and degrees. And MSOE has been a leader in that space, which is one of the reasons why not only are they a local partner of ours, but that we do this event with MSOE. So filling that job gap is a critical issue. This cybersecurity summit has been focused in education since its inception 5 years ago. And in fact, the aim is to drive more interest, drive more awareness. Students are all welcome, free of registration fee to participate in the event. And really, education continues to be a big challenge for the space.
What are SysLogic's partnerships like with colleges and in the academic space? What's working?
So this event and our relationship with MSOE has worked very well. Year over year, it attracts more and more student attendees. We have since bridged and have other academic organizations like Marquette University, like UW-Milwaukee, that have participated in the past and are participating this year. Not just students, but parts of their organization to speak to their cybersecurity curriculums. In fact, we have a number of partners that support us through this event.
Cyber threats, they're ever-changing, and so that means educating this workforce really requires continuing ed, continual training. Is that a challenge for companies?
You know, it has been historically, although what we're seeing with our client base at a minimum is more and more investment in growing their internal cybersecurity resources and expertise. And that comes in the form of many different types of training, a lot of CBT, what we call computer-based training, for example, software developers that work for organizations to better learn how to write secure code and to minimize cybersecurity vulnerability in the products that the companies are building. So we definitely are seeing more and more of a commitment to not only internal training, but then other opportunities externally in the academic environments, as well as to organizations like Microsoft or Google, or AWS, for example.
When you talk about things like writing secure code and thinking about just the proprietary issues for each company, you know, I wonder just how can companies communicate more with each other on their vulnerabilities, on their strategies, on their what's working, in order for everyone to be, you know, safer and have more reliable systems?
That's actually one of the highlights of this type of an event, Kate. So this brings together those technology leaders to share what are best practice, what are lessons learned, how can we work together as a cybersecurity community to improve our risk postures, to really improve how do we deal with it. What is healthcare seeing compared to manufacturing? What type of attacks? How have those organizations dealt with them? Those are the types of sharings and learnings that really expose themselves during this type of an event, and really where a lot of value is captured by its participants.
What should Wisconsin policymakers be thinking about and working on to address emerging cybersecurity issues in our state and really helping our state adapt to what we're seeing that is changing all around us in the digital realm?
So I think there's an opportunity to focus legislation to support companies in their defenses and the actions that they take to ensure that cyber attacks, when they occur, that they don't have a material impact on how we operate as a state. And then, of course, that scales up to the federal level. Cyber investment at the federal level is, give or take, one of the top three expense line items in the Department of Defense's budget. So what does that opportunity look like? It's really whatever legislation or whatever support the state can provide to companies, public, private sector entities, in how do we improve our defenses? How are we working together, more collaboration? And how do we, again, share those best practices to really create as strong of a defense as possible?
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Kate, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure. I really appreciate you having me on your show today.
That was Paul Dukas, Executive Director of Business Development at SysLogic, organizing a cybersecurity summit. It's set for October 11th in Milwaukee. Proceeds from the summit benefit a scholarship fund set up by the Midwest Cybersecurity Alliance. And there's more information about the event at mkecybersummit.com.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, take a trip down Wisconsin's rustic roads and meet two motorcyclists who've gotten hooked on them.
It's all about taking that road less traveled and just creating these stories that you otherwise wouldn't be able to tell.
That's coming up next here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Fall is here, and that could mean taking in the changing colors.
And if you want to take that scenic drive off the beaten path, you can follow those brown and yellow signs that mark Wisconsin's rustic roads.
Our state has 126 rustic roads, and some super fans of the program make it their mission to tour them all. We'll talk with two motorcyclists who are frequent riders on the rustic roads and prefer to take the road less traveled.
First, Liat Bonneville is the rustic roads coordinator at the Department of Transportation. We talked earlier this week about the program.
How did the Rustic Roads program get started in the first place?
It is one of Wisconsin DOT's oldest programs. It was officially created by the Wisconsin legislature in 1973. It was advocated prior to that by Earl Skaggin. That was his concept, his creation. He was a Racine County Highway Commissioner. His very forward idea was a new road classification where the journey along the rustic road is the destination. The very first rustic road, R1, was designated in 1975 in Taylor County. The actual road is called Rustic Road 1. That's the official name. We now have 126 of them, and they cover 61 counties, approximately 760 miles.
Of course, not every road gets to be a rustic road. What are the criteria? What does it take for a road to reach that level, and we can designate it a rustic road?
Well, it is a very grassroots application process. Anybody can nominate a rustic road. Eventually, a resolution by the community that it is in is required as part of the application. And as far as the boxes to check, a rustic road has to be lightly traveled. It has to have outstanding natural features as in wildlife, vegetation, rugged terrain, rustic or agricultural vistas, that set it apart from other roads. It has to be at least 2 miles long. And very importantly, the rustic character of the road, there are no plans in place to change it.
There are, I'm learning, a lot of fans of Wisconsin's rustic roads, people who kind of collect them, who make trips. Could you talk about how people can participate and get even some credentials, some honors for seeking out these roads?
Absolutely. We have what we call a mementos program, where we have awards for traveling the rustic roads by any mode. The most popular mementos program is the Rustic Roads Motorcycle Patch. We also have a keychain as a memento for travelers of the rustic roads outside of motorcyclists, so by any other mode. And every year we have a small number of people that cover all the rustic roads. They get a lapel pin or a keychain and a certificate of appreciation.
Leah, thank you so much for sharing the rustic roads with us today.
You are very welcome. My pleasure.
That was Leah Bonneville, rustic roads coordinator for the Department of Transportation here in Wisconsin. Many motorcyclists are big fans of the rustic roads, and I talked to two of them, Sam Osborne from Oshkosh and Rob Zimdars from Hubertus. We caught up with them last week. Rob, let's start with you. When did you first get involved with chasing the rustic roads of Wisconsin?
You know, I had a rustic road very close to where I grew up, never paid it any attention. And for some reason, I happened to see something online in 2022 about this rustic road challenge. You ride 25 in a year, you get a little certificate. And I thought, well, that's reason enough to get out and explore some different areas. So this will be my third year of doing the 25 roads.
Sam, tell us your rustic roads origin story.
Sure. So it kind of originates back to, I would say, 2020 is when I first found out about the program. Of course, that was the peak of COVID and everything. And a buddy of mine and I, we wanted to get out, get on our motorcycles and explore the state. So we found out about the program and started going out and collecting them from there.
Rob, how many certificates have you put together so far? This is your third year, so I guess you've got two in hand and you're working on a third?
I do have two. I'm working on a third. In fact, I'm leaving in the morning for 4 days of riding, and I'll be collecting 14 along that route, and that'll get me to my 25 for the year. And I'm doing 25 new ones each year. I'm not repeating anything.
And speaking of milestones, Sam, you hit a big one this year.
Yeah, this year, after 4 years in the making and riding more certain years and a little less other years, this year I decided to make it a point and get out and finish. I believe had about 35 or so left this year, and I finished visiting all 126, two of which were actually added this year, I believe. So that was exciting to get out and go to places of the state I haven't been before, quite far from home, and It was a great time, and I'm very happy to have a certificate now to show for it.
Now, the certificates are great, but I imagine for both of you, there's got to be stuff about the nature of the rustic roads that makes you appreciate them. Rob, what is it about rustic roads that made you want to keep traveling them?
Well, there's just no reason to get into some of these areas. It's not a lot of them are in places you wouldn't normally go through. And so you chase one down and find yourself just out in the middle of a beautiful part of the state with scenery and experiences that you otherwise wouldn't have had. That's all.
And Sam, what is it that drew you to keep going after rustic roads?
Yeah, I think Rob hit it on the head there. Of course, collecting per se and visiting all of them and really getting that certificate's a fun part of it, but actually being on these roads, and it really is just about the exact qualities that make a rustic road a rustic road. It's seeing the beautiful parts of our state that are less traveled and getting to experience new places all across the state, from the Northeast to the Southeast to the Northwest to the Southeast. So it's been quite the adventure.
Now, both of you doing this on motorcycles. Sam, let's start with you. What is it about being on your bike that makes the rustic roads extra special?
Being on the bike, it's being out in the elements for sure, as it always is on a motorcycle, especially on rustic roads. There have been many times, especially this year, going out way to the northwest. I can remember specifically riding on long stretches of gravel road, which the motorcycle I was on at the time wasn't most well equipped for that, but it made for a great adventure for sure. Yeah, I would say that's the biggest part of that.
Hey, did you change your equipment after a while to account for the nature of those rustic roads?
Sort of. So actually, after I had finished all the rustic roads, I already had put a large amount of miles on this motorcycle I had. I decided to upgrade to something a little more fitting for going the distance and traveling rustic roads all over again and new ones to come. So.
And Rob, talk some more about the motorcycle experience, particular on rustic roads.
Well, it's such an immersive way to enjoy the state. And to pick up on what Sam said, I was on a Triumph Tiger until last year, and that was great for the gravel roads and the more primitive areas. This year, I kind of splurged on a new Goldwing, and so that's allowing me to get further up into the northwest corner of the state as I'm going on this trip. So different bikes let you experience things in different ways in terms of distance, in terms of road condition. And some of these gravel roads are, as I said, kind of primitive. You know, you find yourself with a little water going across the road and you find yourself in some real remote areas. So there's really a little bit of terrain for everyone's taste.
We are talking about Wisconsin's Rustic Roads and the Rustic Roads program with two big fans. We've got Rob Zimdars from Hubertus and Sam Osborne in Oshkosh with us, both frequent riders of the Rustic Road system in Wisconsin. All right, I want to start naming names. Rob, you mentioned that going on the Rustic Roads takes you to parts of the state that, you know, you wouldn't have reason to go through, might not have a reason to visit. What are one or two that have stood out to you, or ones where you're like, wow, I'm glad this rustic road took me here?
Well, I gave that some thought last night. I thought you might you might ask that. And this might be a surprise to Sam, but down by Potosi in the southwest corner of the state, there's a little rustic road, number 99. It's only 3 miles long. And the reason that one stands out, it's a neat little road. But because I got down there, I explored the area and I ended up taking the ferry across the Mississippi at Cassville. I stayed in Gutenberg, Iowa overnight and found a really cool little restaurant called the Fish Shack. Just kind of a little dive place that kind of hangs over the river. I crossed back over into Wisconsin, ended up on a place called Good Enough Hollow Road, which is a very primitive trail. And then worked my way up through Bagley, which was just beautiful, and up to Wyalusing State Park, which I hadn't visited in 25 years. One of the most beautiful scenic vistas in Wisconsin. And it's all because of that one little 3 mile stretch of road. You know, it's not, wow. these aren't just small stretches of road surrounded by nothing. You know, they're in great areas to explore.
Sam, how about you? What's one or two that have stood out to you?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Of course, it is hard to choose. There are so many. I think it's great that Rob brought up 99. That actually came to mind for me as well. Wow. I would say just the entirety of the Driftless area, but 99 there specifically in the very southwest corner in Grant County. I distinctly remember going through that winding road with the tree line, the Mississippi in the view, train tracks, you name it. It was extremely scenic sight to see. 51 comes to mind as well. That's in the northwest corner of the state in Pierce County. It has a couple water crossings. And of course, on the bike I was on, I told myself I was going to truck through it and I decided to do it. And it was an experience I definitely wouldn't forget. That actually was the very last one I had to complete my 126. So it's very memorable in that regard. But yeah, everywhere you go, you really can't miss these roads. They're great.
All right. Now, what I'm really taking away here, guys, is this is a mindset thing. And I will confess, when I travel, you know, I want to get to the place where I'm going, right? The travel is about getting from point A to point B for me. And wow, I want to break out of this now. Rob, talk about just enjoying the journey, enjoying the road, going through this place you're in.
Just, I guess, just getting out and spreading out a map. and deciding which of these to take on is the start of an adventure. And it sounds like, you know, you mentioned when you go somewhere, you want to get there.
Yeah.
That's kind of a GPS attitude. I think Sam and I are kind of map people, right? You spread out the map, it shows you where you're going, where you are, where you've been. And it shows you alternate detours that you can take between where you're at and where you're going. So it's just helpful in getting us out to explore areas, again, that we wouldn't have stumbled upon otherwise.
Hey, Sam, same question. The journey being, you know, the main point of the whole thing.
Right. And part of this whole Rustic Road journey for me, it has been enjoyable just tracking out. I would go on weekend adventures and I would cross off, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, even 25 roads at a time in a weekend if it called for it. It's all about taking that road less traveled, I guess, as motorcyclists, that's probably something we live by, and just creating these stories that you otherwise wouldn't be able to tell. Just going down an interstate, for example, it's really about creating those memories and remembering these places to tell other motorcyclists in the future.
And Sam, are you also a paper map kind of guy?
Yeah, well, I'm a mix of both, to be honest. I know a lot of guys use paper maps, but it's funny you mentioned that. Electronic maps, I have tracked all of these rides, so I can look back on an app on my phone and actually see every ride I've taken to every rustic road, and it's a bunch of squiggles across the entire state. It's really neat to see, and I love showing people that, to show exactly, hey, on this road, I was on a 20-mile stretch of gravel, I saw this deer cross, and I saw this, you know, I was seeing signs for elk crossing, which, being from the Fox Valley, I'm not used to that, and it just makes for a great story.
All right, I want to leave by asking each of you your next ride that you have planned. Rob, where are you going?
I am leaving tomorrow morning, as I said, for a couple of days. I'll be in Lansing, Iowa, just over the border, and then I'm getting up into the northwest corner of the state where there's a large concentration of rustic roads. So I'll be staying up in the Balsam Lake area and then coming back down through the Driftless on my third day.
And Sam, your next adventure?
So many to choose from in my head, and so little days until the deep, dark, cold of winter sinks in. But something that's definitely been on my mind, I've done this before with a buddy of mine, and now I have a motorcycle that's a little more better at doing this, is motorcycle camping and going camping on a motorcycle. So I'd love to go down to somewhere like Wildcat Mountain State Park or Wildstone State Park and camp out there. It'd be great to see the fall colors, experience the roads during the nice fall weather we have coming up. Definitely something comes to mind for me.
Well, happy travels to both of you. Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And Rob, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, Sam, let's connect after this and chat a little bit more. And congrats on the 126.
That was Rob Zimdars from Hubertus and Sam Osborne from Oshkosh sharing their journeys to hidden corners of the state on Wisconsin's rustic roads. Hey, head over to WPR.org. There's a write-up there with lots of photos and a video series, YouTube video series from another motorcyclist who rates and ranks a lot of these rustic roads. Again, find those all over at WPR.org. Coming days on the show, we'll learn about Guardian Caps. They're these protective foam shells that get put over football helmets. The goal, reducing head injuries and concussions.
The NFL is now allowing players to wear them in games this season.
Have you seen this headgear? What do you think of it? Maybe you're the parent of a football player. Is your athlete wearing a Guardian Cap?
And what are their thoughts on seeing other players wearing them, maybe in the NFL? Do you worry about a bad hit to the head in your sport?
Call or text us at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Or you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
And we may share your stories and thoughts in an upcoming program. Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.